For some people, the perfect summer getaway involves the beach, the mountains, or a trip to far-off lands. But for others, the perfect getaway only requires the imagination. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has some early summer recommendations for armchair vacationers.
Summer is a season when people get hyper-social, with barbecues and neighborhood fairs, graduations and pool parties. In short, it's an especially trying time for those of us who'd rather stay indoors and read a book. The nonfiction books on this list are filled with such marvelous facts and anecdotes, they'll arm you with a supply of handy conversational tidbits should you have to socialize. The letter collection and novels I'm recommending are so absorbing, they'll give you the moral courage to draw the curtains, crank up the air conditioning, and ignore all unwelcome invitations. One of my happiest dinnertime memories from my 1960s childhood is of those nights when my mother would announce that she was taking a vacation from cooking. Out would pop the TV trays and a defrosted silver foil dinner of breaded haddock cut into two isosceles triangles, neon green peas, and a smattering of tater tots. Yum. The dinner may have been Swanson's, but the man to thank is Clarence Birdseye. Birdseye was the father of frozen food, and his extraordinary story as an amateur inventor and world traveler is told in a new biography by Mark Kurlansky, who himself might be thought of as the father of the historical food narrative, given his bestsellers Cod and Salt. This biography, called Birdseye, follows our man as he travels to Labrador in the early 20th century and discovers the trick, long known to the native Inuit population, of deep freezing trout and cabbages in ice and seawater. As Kurlansky points out, these days the locavore movement recoils from food harvested from far away. But Birdseye was a 19th century foodie who dreamed of making food industrial and available to America's burgeoning cities. Cryonic freezers are where Jill Lepore's new book, The Mansion of Happiness, comes to a dead halt. Lepore, who is a historian at Harvard and a staff writer at The New Yorker, where parts of this book already appeared, has written an offbeat history of American ideas about life and death. Lepore's title, The Mansion of Happiness, derives from an early 19th century board game that piously represented life as a voyage whose end was a return to heaven. By the time American game innovator Milton Bradley revamped the game as life in 1860, Lepore says it was no longer imaged as a race to heaven, but rather as a series of hard-nosed economic calculations about the best route to collect the most points, fastest. This chapter alone on the history of children's board games speaks volumes about how American ideas about the meaning of life have mutated. My Dear Governess is a surprising literary discovery that charts a life through letters. In 2009, the letters of Anna Bahlmann came up for auction. Bahlmann was an orphan daughter of German immigrants who served first as a governess and then a companion to Edith Wharton for more than 40 years. 135 letters from Wharton turned out to be in Bahlmann's possession, and they flesh out our vision of Wharton's life as a debutante, disappointed wife, and determined writer. What's also illuminated here is the anxious, frugal life of a society governess. Bahlmann's clothing ledger for 1898, for instance, details a total expense of $290.24. That was a sizable chunk of change for Bahlmann to give over to dresses, gloves, and ribbons in order to make herself presentable in high society parlors. The lonely wise child, who's the heroine of Jane Gardam's newly reprinted 1986 masterpiece, Crusoe's Daughter, doesn't have to worry much about clothes. Polly Flint lives with her two maiden aunts in an isolated house near the Irish Sea. Crusoe's daughter is Gardam's own favorite among her novels, and Gardam reigns as my personal favorite among offbeat female British writers. She melds the desolate humor of a Stevie Smith and the crumpety settings of a Barbara Pym. Who else would dream up these adjectives to describe an odious vicar? Pale, flabby candle grease Father Pocock, with hands like a seal's flippers and a puffy pink sea anemone mouth. Talk about a nightmare of enforced holiday conviviality. Mark Haddon's new novel, The Red House, is a kind of dark, contemporary British version of that cinematic chestnut, Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. Haddon conjures up the emotional discomforts that ensue when a wealthy surgeon invites his feuding sister, her unemployed husband, and their kids to share a vacation house in Wales. Listen to this inspired stream of consciousness grumble from one of Haddon's unhappy vacationers. How strange this yearning for being elsewhere, doing nothing. The gift of princes once, its sweet poison spreading. And now you must do nothing for a week and enjoy it. Days of rest long past the point where we've rested. Holidays without the holy. Pilgrimage become mere travel, the destination handed to us on a plate, the idleness of the empire in its final days. Welcome to summer, everybody.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University.
'Tis the season to rev up the old minivan and hit the road for summer vacation. And one way to stave off those "are we there yet?" questions is to get your family hooked on an audiobook. And the miles will just fly by. And it just so happens that this is the season when there are a lot of new audiobooks to choose from. Just last week, the winners of the annual Audi Awards were announced. These are the awards for the best audiobooks of the year. And we've got the greatest hits from that event, as well as some books that you can road test yourself this summer on your way to the destination of your choice. And to help guide us through our audiobook selections is Adam Boritz. He covers the wide world of audiobooks for Publishers Weekly. He joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so without further ado, who was this year's big winner at the Audis?
This year's big winner was Tina Fey for Bossy Pants. She won the Audi for Audiobook of the Year. She also won for Memoir.
Okay, Tina Fey doing well at the Audis. Let's get a little sample of that.
My dad looks like Clint Eastwood. His half-Scottish, half-German face in repose is handsome but terrifying. I searched the audience for him during the sixth grade chorus concert, and seeing his stern expression was convinced that he had seen me messing up the words to the Happy Days theme and that I was in big trouble. I spent the rest of the concert suppressing terror burps, only to be given a big hug and a kiss afterward. It took me years to realize, oh, that's just his face.
Yeah, she did an amazing job. I think, you know, of all the audiobooks that came out this year, it's probably one of my favorites and one of the most entertaining.
So you recommend another celebrity-narrated book, the autobiography of trumpet player Miles Davis, which is performed by Dion Graham. Let's take a listen to this.
By the time I was 12, music had become the most important thing in my life. I probably didn't realize how important it would become, but looking back, I can see just how important it was. I still played baseball and football, still hung out with my friends like Millard Curtis and Darnell Moore, but I was seriously taking trumpet lessons and was really into my horn.
Such a compelling and distinct voice.
Yeah, I think, you know, Dion Graham, who's probably best known for his role on The Wire, but has been in film, television, and is something of an audiobook celebrity, does an amazing job with that and really kind of inhabiting the character there in a way that I don't think you get with the print edition.
So that's really interesting, though. You think the performance is so important that it can trump good storytelling?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can have a great audio version of a terrible book and a terrible audio version of a classic novel. I think it all comes down to the audio performance.
And for our potential road trippers out there, is there anything you would recommend for that kind of long stretch of highway through, say, the Nevada desert when there are no distractions and maybe you and your family desperately need one?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you're if you're on the desolate highway and you want to lose yourself in a story, I might recommend Nicholas Nickleby. It was narrated by Simon Vance, who is one of the best narrators in the world. It won an Audi Award this year for classics. It comes in at over 30 hours, so if you're going to be on the road for a while, that's probably the one for you.
And what about for families with young kids? You know, you're packing up the whole brood, long drive to the beach, say. Anything that can satisfy a lot of diverse tastes, perhaps?
Yeah, well, I would say you might want to go with, you know, in terms of a family-friendly pick, A Wrinkle in Time. There's a new recording of that from Listening Library, narrated by Hope Davis.
Let's take a listen.
Everybody was asleep. Everybody except Meg. Even Charles Wallace, the dumb baby brother, who had an uncanny way of knowing when she was awake and unhappy, and who would come so many nights, tiptoeing up the attic stairs to her. Even Charles Wallace was asleep.
The kids will enjoy that. Parents will probably remember reading it in their youth, and it could satisfy everybody.
Okay, well, you've inspired me. You've given me all kinds of fodder for plenty of distraction. Adam Boritz is the editor of the publisher's weekly blog, Listen Up. He joined us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much, Adam.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Happy road tripping.
And to you.
When cardiologist Barbara Natterson Horowitz was asked by the Los Angeles Zoo to treat an exotic little monkey in heart failure, she learned that monkeys can suffer heart attacks from extreme stress, exactly like humans. Dr. Natterson Horowitz realized she'd never thought to look beyond her own species for insights into human disease, which led to a collaboration with science journalist Catherine Bowers and years of research that turned up depressed gorillas, fainting fish, and grasshoppers who binge on sugar when frightened by a spider. Their new book is called Zubiquity: What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing.
I started it out very skeptically. As a cardiologist, I just assumed that many of our diseases were uniquely human. But the overlap was extreme. I mean, Cocker Spaniel gets breast cancer, a Siamese cat gets heart failure, a killer whale has Hodgkin's lymphoma. I mean, it really went on and on. And as a physician, what was so intriguing about this and continues to be is how little human medicine knows about animal disease and how utterly relevant that is to human disease.
Let's talk about some of the physical illnesses that you came across. Now, everyone knows dogs and cats can become obese. But one of the things the two of you found that may offer a lesson for human health was the case of the obese dragonflies. Catherine Bowers, tell us about that.
Yes, well, we spoke with an entomologist at Penn State University who is a dragonfly expert, and he calls dragonflies the jet fighters of the insect world. They're lean, they're quick, they're nimble. And he was out by his ponds one time looking at all these different dragonflies, and he noticed that some of them were a little more sluggish than usual. So he took them back to the lab, and he noticed that their wings weren't working quite right. They were collecting fat around their abdomens, and he realized that they had what might be similar to like a pre-diabetic state, and they were infected with a certain kind of parasite that was changing the way they metabolized their blood sugar. So that could have implications for how we look at human obesity.
Right. I definitely had always assumed that it was exclusively diet and exercise that determined my patient's body weight. But we learned that in some animals, for example, in these dragonflies, yes, an infection seems to have been driving the dragonfly's obesity. Which is not to say that, you know, infection is causing obesity in human patients, but it opens up the door to expanding our perspective on things that might be contributing.
There are many things in this book that are surprising that they are not exclusive to humans. And one of them is drug addiction. Catherine Bowers, read us a passage in the book.
In Tasmania, a leading producer of medical opium, users sometimes sneak into the fields. Ignoring security cameras, they hop fences and gorge on poppy straw and sap. Dosed on the drug, they flail around in circles, damaging crops. Sometimes they pass out in the fields and have to be carried away in the morning. And there's no way to prosecute these trespassing scofflaws, no rehab to send them to, because these freeloading opium eaters are wallabies.
And wallabies are a kind of kangaroo.
Yeah, like a mini kangaroo.
Of course, it's a funny image. But what do these stoned wallabies, what do they have to teach doctors about human addiction?
The fact that animals can sometimes seek substances, presumably to change their sensory state, has a lot of implications, I think, for human beings who or have substance abuse problems and even addiction. One of the things we learned is that in some of the animal populations that do seek substances, whether it's the wallabies or the bighorn sheep who seek out lichens, which are hallucinogenic to them, some of the animals seek the drugs and once is enough, and others go back recurrently. So there's this, what scientists call heterogeneity in desire and craving, let's say, and seeking of the substances. So that alone, I think, has meaning for human populations, because it can be puzzling to people, for example, who don't have problems with substances, why someone else does. But seeing that wild animal populations demonstrate differences within the group between individuals of who has that proclivity, I think has meaning not only for scientists in terms of looking at that problem, but also to help sort of pull away some of the shame component that burdens people who are dealing with this very difficult disease of substance abuse.
There are behaviors in the book, and I'll put this one to you, Catherine Bowers, as a science writer, that the behaviors seem counter-evolutionary. For instance, an affliction associated with human adolescence that's known as cutting or self-mutilation.
When animals are under stress, they will often try to make themselves feel better. And one way that animals do this is by grooming. Sometimes veterinarians see that animals actually over-groom in situations where they're stressed out. Cats will lick their paws compulsively. Dogs might chew the base of their tail or spin around in circles. Also, veterinarians have seen horses who bite their flanks.
And Dr. Natterson Horowitz, the horses biting their flanks, why are they doing that?
So before I actually became a cardiologist, I did a residency in psychiatry, and I spent time with some human patients who are cutters. It can be very hard to understand why they're doing it. And yet they tell us that it provides them with relief, which seemed counterintuitive to me. But thinking about it more and looking at what animals do when they're self-injuring, you see that they're over-grooming in an attempt to tap into the neurocircuitry that provides comfort and relief with grooming and dialing it up. Veterinarians know that stress, isolation, and boredom will fairly reliably lead to self-harm in certain animals that are susceptible. Knowing this, they can take steps to prevent stress, isolation, and boredom in their animals. And when an animal does exhibit those behaviors, they have a very specific behavioral agenda to help them. And this is information that I actually think would be really helpful on the human side and cause me to even wonder whether it'd be interesting to have psychiatry residents spend time with animal behaviorists.
Well, just finally, what does it all add up to for you?
So animals and humans get the same diseases, but veterinarians and physicians rarely collaborate and communicate. And this is a loss because there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to develop a broader perspective about disease. In my own practice as a cardiologist, going to the zoo and working with veterinarians has made me a much better doctor.
Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. Their new book is called Zubiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing.
Hollywood is forever going back to the well of books for movie ideas. In theaters right now, you can watch The Hunger Games, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, and most improbably, What to Expect When You're Expecting, based on the best-selling pregnancy advice book. Author Tessa Harris says if it's books Hollywood wants, there are still plenty of gems out there waiting to be discovered. She has this essay for our series, Three Books.
J.D. Salinger famously refused to sell the film rights to The Catcher in the Rye, saying it was unactable. And it's true, the subtleties of such great novels can get lost in translation. So I thought I'd take a look at three of my favourite books that have not yet made it to the multiplex, but which all transport you to another time and another place. My first choice for a movie makeover would be Michelle Paver's Wolf Brother. It's one of those children's books that transcends the genre and has been equally lauded by adults. Set in the era of early man and with a subtle hint of magic thrown in, the first book in her Chronicles of Ancient Darkness series introduces us to Torak. Young and fatherless, he befriends a wolf cub and, you guessed it, the cub speaks English. Together they go on an epic journey that takes them through dense forests and over desolate frozen landscapes. 20th Century Fox has bought the entire rights to the series, But the project has been on ice for several years. Let's hope it thaws out soon. Of course, great film adaptations don't have to involve sweeping vistas and a cast of thousands. Novels that evoke the urban landscape can be equally cinematic. Take Caleb Carr's The Alienist, for example, set in 19th and early 20th century New York. The camera would surely love to follow the progress of reporter John Moore and Dr. Laszlo Kreisler as they, together with a secret forensic team, investigate a string of gruesome serial murders. We'd accompany them into the squalid immigrant districts filled with tenements and narrow staircases. Just think of the great chase scenes down all those dark alleyways in the poorest neighbourhoods of the Lower East Side. Contrast this with the ostentatious wealth of Fifth Avenue mansions inhabited by the likes of the real-life banker J.P. Morgan, and you have a surefire Hollywood blockbuster. From 19th century America, we travel to Renaissance Italy and the city of Ferrara, the setting for Sarah Dinant's Sacred Hearts. How the camera could feast on that divine architecture, hovering seductively over the lush landscape surrounding this northern Italian gem. It would make a stunning backdrop to the gripping tale of a 16-year-old novice who enters a convent against her will, leaving the man she loves behind. Dinant's masterful prose recreates a cruel and rigid world, and there are many moments of high drama. Religious visions, fasting, self-flagellation, and even a stigmatic nun. Ultimately, however, Sacred Hearts is a story of the triumph of the human spirit, where love wins the day. Yet while I admit I'd pay money to see any of these great novels on screen, some authors would probably prefer to stay at home. After all, the greatest multiplex in the universe is inside your mind, and the only ticket you need is a good, well-written novel.
Tessa Harris is the author of The Anatomist's Apprentice, which was originally written as a screenplay. You can comment on this essay at nprbooks.org.
With recent news that even Paris has one, food trucks are officially in vogue. Here in the U.S., they're spreading from the hot scenes in Los Angeles and New York to smaller cities. Food writer and critic John T. Edge set off on a road trip to discover what mobile chefs were cooking up, and he came back with the Truck Food Cookbook. NPR's Debbie Elliott caught up with him, where else? At a taco truck in Birmingham, Alabama.
We park at a Texaco gas station just across the street from the Steel City bolt and screw factory. John T. Edge quickly spots the special, handwritten on a paper plate.
They've got ceviche, which is great to find in a parking lot in Birmingham, Alabama.
This is Taqueria Guzman, one of the first food trucks to show up in Birmingham.
I think I want a tostada de ceviche. How about you?
Let's get one of those and let's get, you tell me.
They've got brain tacos.
I'll pass on that.
We settle on tacos al pastor, the tostada, and two ice-cold bottles of Mexican Coke. Owner Jaime Guzman is taking orders inside the truck.
How long have you been doing this?
Like the business? Since I was a little kid. It's been in my family for a long time already. From California to Atlanta, from Atlanta to Birmingham.
Truck food has had a similar evolution, Edge says, starting in L.A. and New York, then booming in places like Portland and Austin. Now it's a hit in a third tier of cities like Milwaukee and Birmingham. When the food comes, Edge is impressed.
Look how beautifully this is composed. I mean, there's bracketing of the avocado slices, the chop of the cilantro on top. It's not low-rent food. It's artisanal food in this place. On a foam plate, you know?
But at $2 a taco, this artisanal food is within reach for just about anyone in Birmingham. Secretaries, hospital workers, and Hispanic construction workers line up at Guzman's truck. Bail bondsman Terry Sylvester is waiting for her regular lunch.
A lamb burrito. That's the only thing I ever order. He knows exactly what I want. That's how much I come.
TV technician Thomas Lauer comes every Friday. He says it's more fun than a sit-down restaurant.
You meet interesting people while you're standing in line. It's the whole experience of just
standing there with everyone else waiting on your food to come up, and you kind of get to know the people who run the truck and that sort of thing. So the community is a big part of it.
It's a really democratic portrait of America.
John T. Edge tends to view food through a cultural prism. He's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi and a frequent contributor to newspapers, magazines, and the Food Network. His Truck Food Cookbook is part recipe collection, part travelogue, and part cultural analysis of the food truck frenzy. There are recipes for fried Brussels sprouts from Austin, Ethiopian lentils from Madison, and a quirky Hawaiian treat, Spam Musubi.
A little lozenge of vinegared rice with a slab of pan-fried soy sauce doused Spam on top, wrapped with a piece of nori. This is from Marination Mobile in Seattle.
It's one thing for aspiring chefs to peddle their plates on the street, but what's the appeal for those of us just trying to get dinner on the table between homework and the soccer fields? Edge says it's a natural fit.
These truck food cooks are working in really small spaces. They're working with a limited number of ingredients and a limited amount of time, which sounds like a home cook. Like, you know, I don't want to go back out to the grocery store. What's in my pantry?
A recipe he's tried at home is the mac and cheese sandwich inspired by the grilled cheese truck in Venice, California. It's macaroni layered between two slices of cheese and white bread, buttered and griddled.
When you bite in, you get this textural symphony. You bite in, you get the crisp toast on the outside, the gooey cheese, then the chewy pasta. I mean, it's goofball food, but my son, age 11, he's a happy goofball eating it.
John P., you're up.
Now we're at the Shindig's truck in Birmingham.
We got two nut cheese and then one nut bacon.
Co-owner and chef Chad Schofield says the truck moves around to different parts of the city and updates its menu daily.
Today we have our Willis Burger, which is a grass-fed beef with a creamy gorgonzola, bacon, blueberry mostarda, truffle aioli.
All served on a locally made sweet potato bun. Bob Carlton orders one.
Would you like your side salad or the fries, the truffle fries with your burger?
The truffle fries would be wonderful.
Carlton is the food writer for the Birmingham News and has been watching the food truck scene here gain in popularity.
I just think the idea of getting something fast and, you know, getting it relatively inexpensively and, you know, being able to walk outside your office and there's a truck there. And also, I think there's a huge cool factor. It's like, you know, we're a real city now. We have food trucks, you know.
Cookbook author John T. Edge says foodies can now test that cool factor at home, no wheels required. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
To sample recipes from the Truck Food Cookbook, visit npr.org.